program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from John Kenneth Galbraith. Nothing is so admirable in politics as a short memory. That is what Bush was wishing for McClellan. Oh, man. By the way, at the bottom of this hour, if all things go well and the telephone gods to the UK are smiling, George Monbiot is going to be with us. Yesterday, he tried to execute a citizen's arrest on John Bolton, who has been a guest on this program a number of times. And so we want to find out what happened with that. In the second hour of our program, Joe Madison is going to drop by. Joe, along with Rusty Humphreys and a couple other folks, Jack Rice, traveled with me to southern Sudan. We were at Gok Machar, a village that has become a refugee camp, 15, 20 miles, maybe, I'm not sure the exact distance, from the Darfur border. And you can see the photos from that, by the way, at tomhartman.com. Just up at the top, it says click here to see the Darfur pictures. And there are some new developments in Sudan that we really need to be paying attention to. We're talking about as many people dying we're talking about the possibility, certainly already millions of people have died and the possibility of millions more. And it's something that we can stop. And in our third hour, Jonathan Steele, the senior foreign correspondent, in-house columnist on international affairs for the London Guardian, is going to drop by. I'm doing my show today live from San Francisco tonight. Angie Quiro and I will be hosting a conversation. We have invited delegates and representatives of the Clinton campaign and the Obama campaign to join us at 7 o'clock tonight. This is it's open walk-in. You can't even pre-register. Just show up. It's going to be at the Sofitel in San Francisco in Redwood City, 7 o'clock, and have a conversation about, you know, what's going on here with these two camps, and how can we bring this party back together? How can Democrats win and not who's the best candidate? This is not going to be a debate between candidate surrogates. It's going to be, I think, frankly, a much more meaningful and deeper conversation. And we would, for those of you in San Francisco, love to have you show up and participate. So we're flying this one by the seat of our pants. It's going to be interesting, something that we've never done before. In terms of big news, there's a bunch of, shall we call it, big news. Apparently, Scott McClellan in his book suggests that George W. Bush personally authorized the leak of a CIA agent's identity. This is huge. This means that the President of the United States, not only, as Vincent Bugliosi pointed out yesterday, could be indicted, and in fact he's calling for his indictment and conviction, including in states with the death penalty, for capital murder, for first-degree murder, but that he also is guilty of treason. Scott McClellan. Now, I have not read his book, so I have to say apparently. I mean, I'm basing this on news reports, but from what I'm reading, assuming that this is accurate, and I think that that's probably a reasonable assumption, Scott McClellan is asserting that George W. Bush is guilty of what his father referred to as treason. And what I think most people in our intelligence agencies would refer to as treason. Barack Obama just came out and said in his first 100 days, you know, classic 100 days, the first 100 days of an administration, he is going to overturn Bush's unconstitutional laws. Now, there is the right-wing machine in response to Scott McClellan has just gone into hyperdrive. They've gone hysterical. And there's one fascinating thing that's completely or largely missing from the right-wing talking points. And over at Think Progress, they've compiled a list of them. They're in video, and you can see the different faces. And Tony and I Tony's our board op here in San Francisco, and we're gonna play Tony's gonna play these things, and he's gonna briefly pause between each name, or try to. They're jammed together and they step on each other, and I'll just let you know who's speaking. And Tony, you know, fire away.
The problem is that Scott left. He was disgruntled, and a publisher got to him and waved a lot of money, I'm sure, in front of him, and he took the bait, and that is just unfortunate.
Okay, that was Brad Blakeman. He's a former White House staffer. This next one is Trent Duffy. He's a former White House press secretary.
It's like he just turned over the pen to a publisher and signed his name at the bottom and got a big fat book contract.
Now, have you noticed what's lacking yet? What's lacking is anybody calling him a liar. Nobody's calling McClellan a liar. Here's Bill O'Reilly last night.
Talking Points believes Mr. McClellan is in it for the bucks, keeping in mind his publisher also distributes books by George Soros and other far-left people.
This book was published by the same publisher that George Soros is involved in.
Former White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said this on the Radio Factor.
And I talked to Scott yesterday, and Scott did tell me that his editor, and this is Scott's words, tweaked some things closely in the last few months. And I think what did happen, Bill, was the book was pretty well done and set, and Scott went back in. And I think his editor wrote a lot of it.
Yeah. See, again, that was here we had that was Ari Fleischer. There was a Fox News commentator in there. This was all a segment from last night's O'Reilly show. Again, nobody accusing Scott McClellan of not telling the truth. Here's Steve Ducey from Fox News.
Apparently, the publisher did some tweaking. How much? That's a really good question.
And think about it this way. Here's this guy who wants to sell books. You know, he's cut his ties.
This, of course, Newt Gingrich.
And his publisher says to him, now look, you can spice it up a little bit.
Yeah, spice it up a little bit. Nobody used the word lie. Here you have the former press secretary accusing the president of the United States of going to war for two purposes. And this is, by the way, the second of these two purposes has completely fallen off the radar screen in the news reports that I've been seeing, newspapers I'm reading, the news that I saw on TV last night versus to this morning here in San Francisco, completely fallen off the screen. McClellan suggesting that Bush went to war for two reasons. Again, as I have to put the caveat on here, I have not yet read his book, but I think we all have every reason to believe that these news reports by people who have read the book are solid. McClellan suggesting that the two reasons were, number one, to transform the Middle East, whatever that means, and presumably to make it more stable. I mean, in other words, a noble motive. Incompetently and criminally executed, but nonetheless, transform the Middle East, and number one. And number two, to gain political power for Republicans. And that gain political power for Republicans part has completely vanished from the coverage. I mean, it's completely vanished totally from the coverage. So the mustache for justice, as Christy Harvey calls him, Henry Waxman now is saying, okay, that's it. Enough of this stuff. We're going to subpoena Scotty. And that's going to be interesting. You know, Scott McClellan testifying under oath before Congress. And he's a guy who I think will not will show up, will not invoke executive privilege. Now, the other thing, last night I was watching CNN News and from my hotel room here in San Francisco, Anderson Cooper's show. And my jaw dropped. Jessica Yellen was on. This is a woman who worked for ABC News. She worked on the Good Morning America show as their news, as their White House correspondent. She was on other ABC News programs. She started with ABC News back in 2003. Then she went to work for MSNBC for a while. It's now 2008. You know, she's been around through most of the Bush administration. Before that, she was a news reporter in Tampa, Florida for WTVT and an anchor reporter for Central Florida News. Okay, in July of 2007, about a year ago, she moved to CNN, covering Capitol Hill for the network. She's talking to Anderson Cooper last night. And as I'm watching this and Cooper's talking about, you know, well, you know, he's essentially saying, isn't it a shame that McClellan blamed us, the news media, for this war? And she says, quote, I'm quoting her. She says, the press corps was under enormous pressure from corporate executives, frankly, to make sure that this was a war presented in a way that was consistent with the patriotic fever in the nation and the president's high approval ratings. And my own experience at the White House was that the higher the president's approval ratings went, the more pressure I had from news executives. And I was not at this network at the time, but the more pressure I had from news executives to put on positive stories about the president, I think, over time. Anderson Cooper at that point, I don't know if he's trying to shut her up or if he's genuinely shocked, interrupts her and he says, you had pressure from news executives to put on positive stories about the president? She says, not in that exact, they wouldn't say it that way, But they would edit my pieces. They would punish me in different, they would push me in different directions. They would turn down stories that were more critical, and they would try to put on pieces that were more positive. Yes, that was my experience. Jessica Yellen, last night on CNN. That story seems to have vanished, and I'm wondering if Jessica's going to vanish. The media just kind of saying, what? Us? Us? And politics? Politics? A storyline is emerging here. By the way, did you hear what happened in Iran? Right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Is doing it. That's an amazing thing. Scotty McClellan, apparently in the interview this morning, and I don't have the audio of that, but first of all, here's Chris, play this. This is the audio of Scott McClellan this morning on NBC TV.
Had to know this was going to create a firestorm.
Well, I think I expected some of the reaction that was going to come out. The White House would prefer that I not talk openly about my experiences. But I think there's a larger purpose to this book. It's really about looking at this permanent campaign culture in Washington, D.C., and talking about how can we move beyond it.
The administration has come out and said that you're disgruntled, that you're just mad because you got pushed out of a job, and this is your way of getting even by writing this book.
Actually, disappointed is the word that I would use. I'm disappointed that things went so badly off track.
Now, they're also reporting over at Fire Dog Lake, although right now their website is slammed, that in addition, I didn't see the interview, that in addition to this, that during the interview, Scotty revealed the two things that upset the Bush administration. The first was being that upset him about the Bush administration. The first was being lied to by Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. And secondly, learning that Bush himself authorized the selective leaking of the National Intelligence Estimate. Interesting. Very interesting. I promised you what happened in Iran. This actually, I think, is much bigger news than Scott McClellan's revelations that George W. Bush is a criminal, that Rove is a criminal, that the war was lies, and all, because we already knew all that stuff. We didn't have it confirmed by an insider. The media is all going, oh, we never imagined. But, you know, I think most Americans figured this out a long time ago. It's 30% approval rating. But what happened in Iran yesterday, there was an election. There was an election in Iran on Wednesday for the Speaker of the Parliament. And the new Speaker is Ari Larijani. And he's the former chief nuclear negotiator for Iran. And the guy who ran against Ahmadinejad in the last election to be the president of Iran. Now, what's significant about this, you probably have no idea. You know, I don't think most Americans have ever heard of Larijani's name, other than that there was this guy who challenged Ahmadinejad during the last election. Well, Larijani, it turns out, is the, quote, moderate, end quote. He's more, I don't want to say he's pro-U.S., but he's a guy who is not. He's not hysterical about the U.S. and if anything, you know, he's a moderate. I mean, here's the story in the New York Times today. In a potential major political shift in Iran, a rival of the president was elected by an overwhelming majority as Speaker of Parliament on Wednesday. He won the Speaker position 231-31. The overwhelming result appeared to be a commanding rebuke of Ahmadinejad. It's also a strong indication of his waning support among parts of Iran's senior leadership. And analysts said such an election result could not have been possible without the backing of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, who, by the way, has issued an official decree saying that enriching uranium to the point where it can be used as a nuclear weapon is a sin and will not be done by the country. So, you know, Iran is continuing to say, yes, we're enriching uranium, and yes, we're doing it to fuel nuclear reactors that will provide us with electricity. Period. End of discussion. This is the guy that was the negotiator. This is a guy who is viewed as a moderate. And this may be the end of Ahmadinejad. And what's going to happen if the U.S. bombs Iran? Ahmadinejad will be back with bells on. I mean, you're going to see like nothing before. All of a sudden, it's going to be all Ahmadinejad all the time in Iran because we're going to so anger and alienate the Iranians that they're going to rally around the right-wing crazy. And this moderate is going to get pushed out. So, you know, again, another Bush policy that will probably, or Bush-McCain policy that will backfire. Henry in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Henry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
I hear you. Well, I'm going to get to it real quick and kind of make a few quick points real quick. Number one, the reason why they couldn't call that man a liar, nothing like that, because, you know, there's a thing called defamation of character. They know a lot of these things are going on in the media, and they knew that, you know, they were pretty much fed, feed to what to say on television and what to say in the newspapers and things of that nature. I'm not saying the whole media is like that, but let's not forget. The Murdoch Enterprise and a few other conservative clonies, I guess you could say, they pretty much bought up all the news media across the country.
Yeah.
And then they consolidate a lot of radio stations, newspapers, things like that, and they pretty much put out what they want, when they want, and how they want.
Well, and this is why Jessica Yellen's comments last night to Anderson Cooper is so shocking. You know, she's telling the truth, too.
Look, we're talking about Mr. Cooper, O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, not to be funny, but, you know, if them guys, I have all the respect for life in this world. But I'll tell you something, if them guys was on fire, I wouldn't waste my state. I'd walk the other ring.
I wouldn't go that far, but I get your point that you don't have a lot of respect for the news media in this country.
You can't believe half the things that guys say. And as for the situation now, say, like, with Hillary right now.
Henry, I'm sorry. We're just flat out of time, and certainly not enough time to change the topic. But yeah, we have really been disturbed by our news media. And are they going to continue to delete that from the story? I think so. George Monbiot up, hopefully next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That they can't rebuke. He said Saddam was buying stuff to build a nuke. Well, let's roll. Everybody, let's roll.
Yeah. If I'm gonna play the game. Well, Scotty McClellan, I mean, it just keeps on coming. He's the gift that doesn't stop giving. This is amazing. This morning on NBC, Scott McClellan coming out and saying that George Bush told him that he personally authorized the leaking of the identity of Valerie Plame. This is mind-boggling. The president is guilty not just of murder, but of treason? And these are really strong words. We live in strange times, my friends. And some might even call them crazy times. Our crazy alert for the day from the wire services, as we like to call them. Bush refuses to read McClellan's book. Why? On a day when Washington was abuzz with the news that former White House spokesperson Scott McClellan had published a tell-all memoir, President George Bush offered his personal reason for not reading it. I have no intention of reading Scott McClellan's book, Mr. Bush told reporters, because it's a book. Mr. Bush said he was surprised that Mr. McClellan had written a book to criticize him because, quote, if you're trying to communicate some criticism to me, a book is pretty much the last place you'd put it, end quote. The president said he thought the chances of his someday reading Mr. McClellan's book were zero, adding, if I didn't read the Iraq Study Group's report, I really don't think I'm going to read Scotty McClellan's little book. Presidential historian Davis Longston of the University of Minnesota observed that if Mr. McClellan honestly expected his memoir to somehow reach Mr. Bush's nightstand, quote, that demonstrates just how little he knows George W. Bush. Scott McClellan would have had better shot if he put his memoir on an Xbox 360 format and slipped it into a package labeled Grand Theft Auto 5. For his part, Mr. Bush says that there was, in fact, a book published this week that had caught his eye, the new James Bond thriller entitled Devil May Care. Now, that sounds like a book, a good book. That book sounds like it might be good, he said. Maybe I'll have Laura read it to me. And thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for sometimes the most cogent news of the day. News, of course, tongue-in-cheek. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. We're still working on trying to get George on the line here in the UK. Hey, Rick, what's up?
I commend you, Tom, for discussing this, and Mr. McClellan for writing this book. Now, one analogy I think of, even though I don't think Mr. McClellan is a gangster, you remember Joe Valachi, don't you?
Valachi papers? Yeah, oh yeah.
Well, now, nobody called him a liar either, did they? I mean, granted, the man was a thug and a murderer, probably, which Mr. McClellan is not.
Right.
But nobody said that when he revealed the inner workings of what they called Cosa Nostra rather than the mafia, that he was lying about anything.
Right. Just that broke open the whole, it broke open the whole lie that J. Edgar Hoover had been holding together.
That there was no such thing.
Right. That he'd been being,
even though Hoover tried to cover himself by saying, oh, yeah, I knew about the Cosa Nostra, but I was just saying there was no mafia.
Right, yeah. But see, Hoover was being blackmailed by Traficante, so, you know, he had
about his
relationship with Clyde Tolson.
To get back to the subject, I was heartened to hear you say that, you know, what Bush is doing is treason, murder, violation, certainly, of his constitutional oath. But here's the thing, too. Now, I'm not saying that Bush or the Republicans are Nazis, but just in terms of the invasion of Iraq vis-a-vis the invasion of Poland by Hitler for no reason, even though Hitler claimed, I guess, there were weapons of whatever kind of mass destruction. But how is that any different? When you invade a country that has done nothing to you, isn't that a violation of international law?
Yeah, arguably our invasion of Iraq is identical to Hitler's invasion of Poland. The problem is that you use the word Hitler. And you know, Hitler did things that went way beyond invading Poland,
but
the Holocaust.
This act alone.
We need to find probably other historical examples, but that's, you know, interesting point. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. I'm just wary of going down the Hitler road, but, you know, certainly our attacking another country that doesn't represent a threat to us, not a good plan. Is it Letty in Appleton, Wisconsin?
Hello.
Hi, Letty.
I was watching all that coverage yesterday as well. I remember when the book first was, the part of it was leaked about the Valerie Plame issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you may not have heard what I heard, but you said that the two things were that Bush wanted to change the Middle East.
Right.
I believe the term that Scott McClellan used was coercive democracy. That if Iraq fell into the hands of democracy, then the rest of that region would fall in line.
Right.
He also stated that in the book, apparently it was quoted, Bush said that only great presidents are war presidents. That's the way that history looks at war presidents, as being great.
Right.
And he wanted to create this war because he wanted his legacy to be that he was a great president.
Yeah.
So it was completely ego, maniacal.
Yeah, and all the more of the tragedy. I mean, it's just, yes. Well said. Thank you very much. Dave in Los Angeles, listen on K-Talk. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. I was watching that coverage yesterday afternoon. I saw this develop early on where David Gregory started coming right out and saying that, no, they did their job.
Right.
These
guys are in major butt-covering mode.
Exactly. And the point I want to make is, you know, Scotty obviously put him in a double bind. They all knew that the Bush administration was lying, and they were all trying to report on it in some manner or fashion within the corporatocracy that they have up there. But now they have to come out and say, yeah, and we weren't doing our jobs. But I think the American public is way ahead of this. And I think the winners, I hope the news execs are paying attention. And I think the clear winner will be the first network that comes out and has a Richard Clark moment and says, we failed you. I think the public knows this. At least 79%
right.
Know that they were failed. And I wish they would just come out and admit that. I think it would be best. They're competing with the internet. They all complain it's the internet that's driving down the news business. I beg to differ a bit. I think folks are driven to the internet to find the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on, Dave. And another indictment of corporate media in America, and this massive accumulation of power by a small number of networks who are not even primarily in the network business in most cases. Disney is primarily not in the network business. NBC or General Electric is primarily not in the network business. But their business interests, I mean, this is downright spooky. Chris in Chicago. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm just wondering, with this Scott McClellan thing, are the Democrats finally going to actually do something so that we can go down and hit
Henry Waxman has subpoenaed him if the news reports I'm reading are right. Henry Waxman has issued a subpoena for Scott McClellan. And if McClellan could be the John Dean, he could be the guy who says the things under oath before Congress that make it impossible for Congress to back away. You will recall that when John Conyers was on the Judiciary Committee back in the day, and I'm forgetting now who the congressman was who was the chairman of that committee at the time, but in any case, when that committee first started their investigations into Watergate, all of the Republicans on the committee were opposed to reporting anything out of committee, any articles of impeachment, period. And a number of the Democrats were opposed to it. It was perceived as a fishing expedition, and I'd say probably most of the American public was opposed to it. Within about 2 months, once the existence of the White House tapes came out, once the smoking gun was found, all of the Republicans on the committee and all the Democrats on the committee said, okay, that's it, refer to the House for impeachment. And that was the point at which Richard Nixon had to say, okay, time to get out of here. So I, the bottom line for me, Chris, I think that what's going to happen is what I hope is going to happen is that Waxman will have, and Conyers probably too, that there's your House Judiciary Committee, which is where impeachment has to originate. We'll have Scott McClellan come in and testify under oath, and he will say things under oath, as I suspect he will, that will lead directly to the impeachment of Bush, which will prevent Bush, if he's under impeachment, I understand, will prevent him from pardoning anybody involved in his crime. It'll also prevent there from being any possibility, and this was the Supreme Court case. Richard Nixon went to the Supreme Court and said, enough already, I have executive privilege, you can't have the White House tapes. And the Supreme Court said, no, if we're looking into the possibility of criminal wrongdoing by the president, and see, an impeachment is an indictment for high crimes and misdemeanors, in other words, criminal wrongdoing. The Supreme Court said, in an investigation of criminal wrongdoing by Congress of the president can no longer assert executive privilege. He has no immunity. He has to turn the stuff over. There can be things put into place to prevent things from being leaked to the public. There can be, secret sessions, things like that. But he cannot prevent Congress from having access to that information. Period. End of discussion. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas. Hey, Vic, got about a minute before the break here. What's up?
Well, that's all it'll take. We got to get one of those or several of those 400 and some odd attorneys, lawyers, that are in the Congress and Senate to file charges. That fellow with the Valachi deal and the organized crime, he's exactly right. And I had the United States Code, Title 18, from the beginning of all this garbage, and it was Section 371. It's a conspiracy to commit an offense to defraud the United States. And it says if two or more persons conspire either to commit an offense against the United States or to defraud the United States or any agency in the manner of that purpose, one or more persons to act, da-da-da-da-da, it says it's a punishment, it's a misdemeanor, it's punishment not to exceed punishment provided for a misdemeanor. That's a minor thing. It's in prison, talks about imprisonment for 5 years. They got
5 years in jail.
Somebody's got to file the charges. Tom.
I agree with you, Vic. I agree with you, and I think Wexler is getting ready, but I think it needs to be originate in the Judiciary Committee. The big question is, does this raise to the level of...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
half minutes before the hour. So as I was saying, it's a real question. Why is the press not asking this? They should ask this of every single Republican who was in Congress in 1990, what was it, seven, that Clinton was impeached? 1998? I think it was, maybe it was 1998. Every single Republican who was in Congress who voted for that should be asked the question, do these crimes that are being alleged to have been committed by George W. Bush and members of his administration, do they rise to the level of getting a little on the side from a White House intern who happens to be an adult? Do they rise to that standard, that high, high standard for impeachment that has been established by the Republican Party, that we will not impeach a president of the United States unless he has had, unless he has done something so terrible that it rises to the level of having had sex with somebody with whom he's not married but is a consenting adult? And, you know, by Bill Clinton's definitions, it wasn't even sex. But even setting that aside, you know, oh, man. Here is Scott McClellan this morning on NBC, this breaking the big story that may not even be in his book. I mean, he might have just let this slip, where he says, in essence, well, as you're listening to this, listen to, particularly to the end, where he tells the president that the reporter is suggesting that it was Bush who leaked Valerie Plame's name, who committed treason, that Bush was the guy who authorized this. And listen to what he says about what George Bush says. Here's the clip.
But the other defining moment was in early April 2006, when I learned that the president had secretly declassified the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq for the vice president and Scooter Libby to anonymously disclose to reporters. And we had been out there talking about how seriously the president took this selective leaking of classified information. And here we were learning that the president had authorized the very same thing we had criticized.
Did you talk to the president then and say, why are you doing this?
Actually, I did. I talked about the conversation we had. I walked on to Air Force One. It was right after an event we had down in the South. I believe it was North Carolina. And I walked on to Air Force One, and a reporter had yelled a question to the president, trying to ask him about this revelation that came out during the legal proceedings. And the revelation was that it was the president who had authorized or enabled Scooter Libby to go out there and talk about this information. And I told the president, that's what the reporter was asking about. He's saying that you yourself were the one that authorized the leaking of this information. And he said, yeah, I did. And I was kind of taken aback.
And he said, yeah, I did. And George Bush, his press secretary, Scotty McClellan, says, that reporter says that you're the guy who authorized the leak of Valerie Plame's name. And Bush says, yeah, I did. Man, it's like hubris, hubris on steroids. It's just incredible. AJ in Chester, Connecticut. Hey, AJ, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First of all, the sound you hear in the distance is the whistle of what goes around coming around.
Yep.
But seriously, nobody's brought this up yet. I would urge everybody to collectively watch our backs, because these are animals up against the wall, and that's the most dangerous position to put anyone, anything. And would we really put it past Darth Vader and his gang of spooks to make something go bang somewhere?
Hey, AJ, we don't even need to speculate about what it is. They're out there pushing. We had, you know, one of the architects of this whole thing on our program 3 days ago. They're pushing to drop bombs on Iran to kill the Quds Force. That's 80,000 soldiers. That's like having Canada come in, or Mexico come in here, either one, or the Soviet Union would probably be a better, Russia. Have Russia come over here and drop bombs in San Diego and take out a Marine Corps base, or wherever the Marine Corps bases are stationed around the United States, and just kill every Marine that they can find in the country. I mean, that's what they're talking about doing. And if you think that that's going to be without consequence, that there won't be blowback from that, you know, it's exactly what you're talking about. Create an incident,
you know, put us back into a war footing. It sure worked well for them the first couple of years. It's absolutely incredible. Bob in San Francisco, listening on Green 960, where, by the way, tonight we'll, at 7 o'clock, we'll be down at the Sofitel in Redwood City. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, okay, the topic of that meeting, at least, is going to be the Saturday session with the Democrats. And worried that that or something shortly after that could present us with a fait accompli dream ticket. Now that Hillary is running for vice president, I mean, it's being denied, but for a day I knew that Bill was out there pushing for that.
Yeah.
And then on the Friday, she's suddenly making this comment about Bobby Kennedy. And then I watched Chris Wallace interviewing Terry McAuliffe. Oh, no, Bill, nobody's running for vice president. Yeah. Well, that's the comment makes perfect sense of the fact that she is running for vice president. And all the delegates they're talking to are being invited to hedge their bets. If they've run against a constituency to go for Obama, they've got a chance for redemption by putting her in the second slot, and that could happen anytime they need to stop the litigation or whatever she's going to do to hold this thing open until August.
It's not inconceivable, and frankly, Barack Obama, when he was asked about this, said he referenced Doris Kearns Goodwin's book. I'm forgetting the title of it now, but it's not Band of Brothers, Band of Rivals, I think it's something is the title, and yeah. And how he put a guy from the opposite party on as his vice president, Andrew Johnson. And he put the people who hated him most on, you know, into his cabinet. You know, Stanton and Stewart and all these guys, you know, one of them had called him an ape. I mean, you know, he brought together people. He found what he thought were the best qualified people and people who had support across the United States and brought them into his cabinet. And frankly, I think if Barack Obama does that and puts Clinton on the ticket with him, or for that matter, if this all plays out, that she ends up being the presidential nominee and she puts him on the ticket, that I think it'll easily be John McCain, in my humble opinion.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman Program. Behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
Well, we've got election news. We've got Ari Fleischer trying to spin Scott McClellan's incredible revelation. Not just Ari. We've got the entire news industry in the United States trying to pretend that they had nothing to do with the war. And I want to get back to that in the next segment. Katie Couric said something this morning that was shocking. I mean, it just in that regard, it's just incredible what is coming out. We have Ari Fleischer, or we have Scott McClellan accusing George W. Bush of being the guy who outed Valerie Plame. You know, high crimes and misdemeanors all over the place. Let us not forget, though, that at the same time that high political drama. And, the Rules Committee this weekend, and we're going to be talking about that. I'm here in broadcasting live today from our affiliate in San Francisco, Green 960. And tonight they're sponsoring a gig down in Redwood City where we're going to have Clinton and Obama representatives and delegates, actually. And Angie Coiro and I are going to be co-hosting this, a conversation about how can we heal this country. I'll be on Angie's show for our San Francisco listeners, by the way, at 3 o'clock this afternoon. But that's at 7 o'clock tonight at the Sofitel in Redwood City. Just show up. It's $10 to get in. It's a fundraiser for the Democratic Party. We've got all that, but at the same time, people are dying all around the world. And perhaps one of the real flashpoints, and one that it sure seems to me is about to get a whole lot worse, is Sudan, South Sudan, Darfur, that region. And Joe Madison was kind enough to help Talk Radio News put together a trip to southern Sudan, to the border with Darfur. He's been there a number of times. Ellen Ratner and Rusty Humphreys and Jack Rice and I went, my son Justin, we all went with Joe on this last trip about 2 months ago, Joe?
March 11th, actually, was the 10th, what, 8th to the 18th, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you recall, at the time, we met with the president of Southern Sudan. And told us straight up that all sides were preparing for war.
Right.
And sure enough, you know, like a month later, some of the people we actually saw, people who took care of us while we were there, Tom, many of those people have been killed. Because the government of Khartoum basically got involved in ethnic cleansing. They raided those villages because they want to clear the area so that they can drill for oil.
Let me properly introduce you, Joe. We're talking with Joe Madison, the Black Eagle. He's on XM Channel 169 and also a station in Washington, D.C., The Power. And, Joe, I don't have your website.
It's easy, joemadison.com.
Okay, I figured. It wasn't in my show document here, but I'm not in my normal studio.
Yeah, joemadison.com, www.joemadison.com.
One of my favorite people, a brilliant talk show host, and somebody who's been very active in trying to prevent these atrocities and stop this genocide. Now, the South and the North, as we learned, had this war that lasted about 20 years, and go ahead.
No, I was saying you're right. I was disagreeing with you.
Yeah, okay.
What you said. Yeah.
Right, and then this comprehensive peace agreement, the CPA, was supposed to stop that war, and there was a city on the border that was sort of in dispute, and as the Chinese started finding oil in the south, that border, the north started wanting to move that border south, and that city got taken out last week.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? Because we found out they had a part of the agreement, Tom, as you told your audience, and I've been listening, and you've been so accurate in your description, is they had a line, a demarcation line. In other words, all the oil found north of this line would, in essence, go 100% would go to the government of Khartoum, the Arab government in Khartoum.
Mr. Bashir, the guy who where Osama bin Laden used to live. The guy.
That's
who,
right.
The
and
guy
all,
who, two of the members of his cabinet, by the way, have been indicted in The Hague for war crimes. And
right.
And what did he do? He promoted them.
And by the way, our own intelligence agency has entertained some of them. And when I say entertained, flown them to this country and have actually tried to cooperate. I have an article right now from the Sudan Tribune where the Bush administration is suggesting they might end sanctions against the government of Sudan as a carrot to get them to stop genocide. This has never worked before. I got to give credit. You know, with all this political drama going on, was it not great news to read in the New York Times today that McCain, Clinton, and Obama signed a joint statement saying that whoever gets elected president, they will deal with the government of Sudan in a forthright manner.
Right. This is the actual language of that statement. It says, if peace and security for the people of Sudan are not in place when one of us is inaugurated as president on January 20th, 2009, we pledge that the next administration will pursue these goals with unstinting resolve. Isn't Bush, though, ending the sanctions with Sudan? I mean, he just gave a speech in Israel about appeasement.
That's the very definition of appeasement.
Yeah, it's like, you know,
definition of appeasement.
Right. What Neville Chamberlain did was not talk. The appeasement wasn't talking to Hitler like that right wing, you know, crazy who was on Matthew's show. What Hitler did was he gave him the Sudetenland. He gave him part of Czechoslovakia.
That's the definition of appeasement. Talking is not appeasement. Appeasement is when you give up something in exchange for a promise or for that. And here you have a man who is responsible for genocide in Darfur, who is now raiding villages, and let me tell you, if this peace accord, as you know, and you've seen that you've been, see, it's one thing being there and seeing it, another thing being behind a microphone and being disconnected. But these are civilians who are unarmed, who many of them, as I said, haven't even seen a light bulb. And they just shoot them down. They mow them down. They
and the, last week, this was a town of 100,000 people. It is now nothing but ashes and burned bodies. 100,000 people.
Everybody is gone. 100,000 people, in essence, have scattered, and they are gone. They are gone. And now what the government does, it will go in, and in essence, it will start, with along with the Chinese, it will start drilling for oil. And then 100% of the oil that they find will go to the north, and the south, in essence, won't get any because they will have claimed that that village was north of the demarcation line. Right. This is a very serious game, and I had a conversation with Colin Powell, very brief one, and also Congressman Donald Payne, who I would hope you could get on the show.
He's been on the show.
Oh, great. Both men separately in different conversations said this cannot be resolved militarily. Understand right. There was a 26-year civil war and neither side won. They fought to a standstill. And now that they're trying, they're getting ready to have a referendum to determine whether they will or will not be a separate Sudan. And this is part of the effort to disrupt that vote. And it's also far more serious than before, Tom, because as you also know, they were repatriating people back to southern Sudan so they could take a census to determine who could vote and how many would vote. So you have now millions of people coming back after the Civil War,
right,
trying to find some place to live, and now they're being subjected to this type of unbridled violence.
Yeah, it is absolutely mind-boggling. We only have 30 seconds left. What's the call for action for our listeners?
Well, the call for action is, I think, all sides, just like all of us were over there, different political persuasions, Rusty on the right, you on the left. I mean, all of us got together and we all came common ground, and I think we have got to make sure the media keeps this in the forefront. They've got to do what you're doing, Tom. It has to stay in the forefront or we're literally going to see millions of people dying, being mowed down in the next several months and years to come.
Amen. And as we're speaking, hundreds of thousands of people are dying or at risk of dying.
As we speak, this
ongoing genocide in Darfur that is being perpetrated by the government of North Sudan and Mr. Bashir's government, and that Bush is cuddling up with. And the media
ought to promote the fact that all three candidates came together. We ought to be hearing that and reading it.
JoeMadison.com. Hey, Joe, thanks.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, man. I'm just telling you, it's an incredible. StopGenocideNow.org, another great website. If you go over to TomHartman.com, you click on the photos from our trip to Darfur. There's a link from that to the international charity that was helping sponsor this thing, Christian Solidarity International. And we went with them and flew in the hold of a cargo plane strapped to about, I don't know, 4 or 5 tons of food. And, it's real. It's going on. In the meantime, real and going on, what is coming out, what is unraveling, this whole thing is unraveling. The Dwight Eisenhower coined the term the military-industrial complex. Or if he didn't coin it, he certainly popularized it. And by the way, a little fact check here. John Lay sends me a note. He says, Tom, you're such a stickler for facts. Please note that Andrew Johnson was the vice president during Lincoln's second term. It had nothing to do with the premise of Goodwin's book. The VP for the first term of the cabinet was Hannibal Hamlin. Right. Although I would submit to you that his choosing a Democrat as his vice president for his second term was just a continuation of that policy of Lincoln's of reaching out to the people on the other side. But you know, point well taken, and you're right. And it's not what her book was about. But anyway, back to what's unraveling. What we're seeing unravel here is the military-industrial government media complex. And that's really very much what it has become. It has become a synthesis of big corporate media that is driven not by a desire for the truth or facts, because it used to be at law that the truth and the facts, I mean, not that the government was the arbiter of truth, but that at least programming in the public service had to exist. And so truth and facts actually got out there. And news organizations did not take guff from government officials because, you know, they just didn't have to. I mean, the law was on their side. And, you know, yeah, there were some, but, you know, Edward R. Murrow, I don't think ever in his life rolled over. Instead, they stood up because they, in part, they had to, and in part, they knew that that was their job. Well, the news organizations now don't think of themselves as news organizations. They think of themselves as profit-making divisions of the entertainment branch of ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, etc., that are there to make a profit, that are there to bring eyeballs to advertisements for which they can charge money. And because, and the way that they make a profit is by delivering something that appears to be news, but in fact is commentary or entertainment, infotainment. The most glaring example is, of course, the Fox News Channel. But I'm telling you, it's happening right across the board. Here's Katie Couric on I believe this was on the Today Show, or it might have been, actually I'm not certain of the source of this. In the last 24 hours, though, she and two other news anchors were doing this little tour around, and she was talking about the pressure that they got. Fire this clip, Chris.
And he says that we didn't do our job, and we didn't ask the tough questions, and we let the administration get away with what they were trying to do. And I just am curious for your take on this.
We have different points of view, and I'll start by saying I think he's fairly accurate. Matt, I know when we were covering it, and granted, the spirit of 9/11, people were unified and upset and angry and frustrated. But I do think we were remiss in not asking some of the right questions. There was a lot of pressure from the Bush White House. I remember doing an interview, and the press secretary called our executive producer and said, we didn't like the tone of that interview. And we said, well, tough. We had to ask some of these questions. They said, well, if you keep it up, we're going to block access to you during the war.
And then what happened? Well, it seems they didn't keep it up. I mean, she didn't go any farther than that, as far as I can tell with that. But I mean, this is what we've come to, this unholy alliance between a for-profit press, a for-profit war machine, and a White House which is wholly and a Republican Party and large elements of the Democratic Party that are wholly owned subsidiaries of corporate America. I mean, that's how bizarre it has gotten. That's how intense it has gotten. This, the military-industrial complex. Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico on KTRC. Hey, Chris, got a break coming up here pretty quickly.
Okay, Tom, I just really quickly wanted to point out what you're describing, the military-industrial media confluence with our government. That's almost the definition of fascism, isn't it?
Yeah, it gets right down there where Mussolini was talking about, or actually Giovanni Gentile writing, you know, on behalf of Mussolini for the Encyclopedia Italiana, that fascism is the merging of state and corporate interests.
Have a good day.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris. Good to hear from you. I mean, that is just absolutely, that's what it is. That's what we're seeing. You know, has the United States slid into fascism? Are we now a fascist nation by the definitions of Mussolini? You know, forget Hitler and the death camps and all that stuff. That's, obviously, don't forget it, but I mean, I'm not trying to assert that that's what we're Although we do have our own camps down in Guantanamo Bay, our own concentration camps. I remember when Halliburton got the contract to build the death chamber down there at Guantanamo Bay. Remember, we talked about this on this program. Screaming headlines in the British and European newspapers. Death camp being built at Guantanamo Bay for the executions of the guys they find guilty.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
Clellan out there playing the role of the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes, or in this case, saying that the emperor lied us into a war because he thought that there would be some advantage to, to him in this. Not just the idea of let's terraform the Middle East, let's change the Middle East, but here's the phrase. Bush saw his opportunity, this is quoting Scotty McClellan, Bush saw his opportunity to create a legacy of greatness, something Bush believes is only available to wartime presidents. You've heard me use the phrase narcissistic personality disorder on this program before in reference to George W. Bush. I think that we just got a definite diagnosis. I mean, this guy wants to be known as great, a legacy of greatness, and has observed that the presidents that we remember who were the greatest, George Washington, the Revolutionary War, Abe Lincoln, the Civil War, Wilson, I'm not sure, got all that great a rap out of World War I, but Roosevelt, World War II, were considered great. What Bush failed to notice was that the Korean War sank Harry Truman. And that Dwight Eisenhower, who many people consider one of the best presidents of the 20th century, or at least a very good president, a highly regarded president, ran in 1952, and I got to say, by the way, let me just, before I even finish this sentence, interrupt myself. I was watching MSNBC a couple days ago, and Pat Buchanan was going off, and he's talking about how Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, either one of them, whoever gets the nomination, there's no way that the Democrats going to win this time because he said anti-war candidates always lose. Anti-war candidates always lose. Well, the campaign slogan for Dwight Eisenhower's 1952 campaign for President of the United States, the campaign slogan was end the war in Korea. Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. And in fact, the television ad, and you can go to YouTube and find this thing very easily, the television ad that Eisenhower ran in the 52 election was an elephant, the GOP elephant, walking across a stage. It's a cartoon character. It's like something, it's like Disney, you know, from the 50s. Cartoon character walking across the stage, beating a big drum, you know, the kind of drum that like marching bands have where it's out in front of him. And on the side of the drum, it says peace. And the voice says, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film. And I don't have the audio here with me. I'm in San Francisco. I don't have access to my normal audio, but that is it. And he won. The peace candidate won. Why? Because it was an unpopular war. It was a war that people, the American people, were, hey, you know, we're not winning this thing. We're not accomplishing anything here. This is, you know, it's, and it was going very badly. I mean, it was, people forget how badly the Korean War went. I mean, most people aren't old enough to remember. I'm not old enough to remember it, but, you know, you can read the history. But anyway, here we have another war that's going badly. Lyndon Johnson could have run for re-election. But people in his own party went to him and said, Mr. President, you will not run for re-election because this war is killing America. It's killing the party. You will not run for re-election. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Middleville, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, Tom, I've heard you discuss before, but I just have a personal experience that I could share with you and your listeners. I have 2 years of experience in naval intelligence and 8 years as a Navy SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
And over a dozen instances in that 10 years, I just shook my head and I couldn't believe what was going on. But the biggest one that you probably should recognize is Iran-Contra under the Reagan administration.
Yeah,
they sold surface-to-air missiles to the Iranians.
Yep.
They lied about it. The press let them change the subject. Because of that, we were denied close air support. We had to move an oil plant that we were staging on back. They had done that in 1985, and then immediately afterwards, they reflagged Kuwaiti tankers in American flags and had us escort them through.
Mm-hmm.
And because they had sold them the surface-to-air missiles, we did not have the ability to monitor the Iranians. The Samuel B. Roberts had ten of their crewmen injured when they struck a mine that we would have detected earlier. And we lost helicopters in there. And the press allowed the Reagan administration to change the subject to Nicaragua and the illegal war. They did not focus on the fact that they had committed treason against their own country by selling weapons to a known enemy and a known terrorist nation. And, good people got hurt.
Yeah. And not only that, the reason why they sold those weapons to Iran, when Iran-Contra started unraveling, the Ali Norris of the world were all saying, well, we sold them the weapons in order to get them to release the hostages. But at the time that deal was cut, there were no hostages. There were no hostages in Iran. So the conclusion that many of us have drawn from that is that the deal was actually cut in 1980 during the campaign. And that the deal was, okay, Iranians, you hold the U.S. hostages in the embassy right up into the elections of 1980, right up until November of 1980, which will kill Jimmy Carter, because Carter was 8, 10, 12 points ahead of Reagan in the polls right up until the last 3 months. And it was the hostages that destroyed his presidency or his electoral opportunity. It was the hostages that caused Reagan to win. And if you'll hold those hostages, then we will sell you the missiles and the spare parts that you need to have your military work. And, the Iranians released the hostages to the minute, as Ronald Reagan put his hand in the Bible to take the oath of office, to the minute. And right. And I think that was just them saying to us, ha-ha, look at this, we're in with Reagan now. Where's our missiles? And as you say, we sold them the missiles, and people died as a result of it. And the Reagan administration skated, and they skated, giving Caspar Weinberger and others immunity and pardons, and Ollie North getting out and all these other things. I mean, and then Clinton coming into office and saying, "Nah, we're not going to continue the investigations. That's the past." You know, this is so wrong. And Barack Obama is on record as saying that if he is elected president, he not only will roll back the unconstitutional laws of the Bush administration, but he will maintain investigations into the crimes committed by this administration. And that's got to have a lot of people very, very nervous. Mark, thank
you.
Yes, sir.
Tom?
Yeah.
The thing that you have to realize is that I couldn't believe that when this administration came in power, every single person that was involved in Iran-Contra ended up with a position in the Bush administration.
Yeah, they were all back.
Every single one except for Oliver North, who's working for Fox News.
Yeah.
And then they all had a hand in this war.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Mark, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Catherine in Long Beach, California. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. I just have a couple comments to make. You know, they're vilifying McClellan right now.
Yep.
The press.
Kill the messenger. They're not saying that he's a liar, by the way.
And why didn't they do that before the war? You know, before the war, I sat there watching TV, and all these news people were telling you how to put the duct tape and plastic up on the windows to protect us from weapons of mass destruction. They never questioned. And to go on from there, We have to realize we are occupying that country, and it's going to be like Ireland all over again. 400 years of fighting, and we don't need.
Well, it will be if John McCain is elected president.
Yes.
It won't be if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama.
And by your lips to God's ears, I'm telling you, you know, right before I was listening to PBS and they were saying all the Valium in Baghdad was sold out. Do you know why? The mothers were giving it to their babies. And in Europe, they would show the destruction, the bodies on the ground and the destruction to the buildings. Here, we saw how our airplanes use laser and all these high-tech things. We never saw what happened to humanity at that point.
Yeah. No,
and, it, you know, my friends are from Iraq, and they're the original Christians. They still speak Aramaic. They said, if we go there, we're going to be there forever. And they said, Saddam's bad. However, he has protected the Christians here. And what did we go in on? We're going to protect the Kurds, the poor Christians. They're getting slaughtered as we speak.
Oh, and there's a diaspora. I mean, they're fleeing the country.
They're
fleeing the country.
Absolutely.
Those who have not been murdered. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
What happens now? You know, if Obama does not get in there, we're going to be in war for the next 1,000 years. You can't, there's an old Irish song, and it said, the strangers came and tried to change things their way. We can't give them our religion. We can't give them our democracy. They're their own people.
Yeah.
They like what they had.
You can't shove, well, they might not have liked Saddam, but eventually that too would have passed.
Look at Castro.
Oh, yeah, exactly. This too shall pass. You cannot shove democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun. It
absolutely
does not work.
Absolutely.
It simply
so,
does
you know,
not work.
Let's see our press now. Let's continue watching them harangue McClellan and ask them all these hard questions. Where were they when the war was starting?
Yeah.
Where
Amen.
Was our press?
Amen. Catherine, very, very well said. Thank you very much. It is an embarrassment. It is, well, it's more than an embarrassment. It's a crime. This is what happens when the Sherman Antitrust Act is not enforced. That's really the bottom line here. 45 minutes past it.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you in part, by the way, by the Teamsters, teamster.org, their website, where you can find out more, you know, really all about, you know, what's going on with the Teamsters, what they're up to these days, and the fine work that they're doing. Right now they're working against the so-called fair trade agreement with Colombia. Free trade, what, you know, crazed trade, shall we say. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jimmy in Miami. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I really like your show, Tom. I listen to a lot of AM radio, and I try to get the perspective of both sides, left and right.
Mm-hmm.
So I do listen to Rush once in a while. So my question is this. What do you say to the right-wingers that actually do not blame Bush for the war in Iraq, for going to Iraq, but they say that it was based on intelligence that he had, that
right.
It wasn't his option, but it was intelligence, that was bad intelligence, bad information, and it wasn't his fault. Because that's the main argument that they have, and you know, that the Iraq war wasn't that Bush misled people, it's just that he was basing the decision on what he had as far as intelligence.
No, I understand. And the National Intelligence Estimate, which was the intelligence that he said he was basing the war on in 2002, that he was given by all of the intelligence, I think it was 18 intelligence agencies at that time, the combined thinking of all of those intelligence agencies was given to George Bush, and it said, it was declassified in 2004, this is in 2002, and it said that Iraq did not present a threat to the United States, and that in all probability there were no weapons of mass destruction. It was Congress wanted a declassified version of that. The White House declassified a shorter version of it, and it was given to Congress. And ultimately, 2 years later, the entire thing got out. But, you know, the declassified shorter version was given to Congress and selected members of the press. The declassified version eliminated that. It omitted that part of the intelligence report. So the facts of the matter, and all you have to do is read the National Intelligence Estimate that was declassified in 2004. From 2002, the information that was given to Bush, Bush knew that Iraq represented no threat to the United States whatsoever. He knew it. And so it wasn't that he was given bad intelligence. It was that they cherry-picked the intelligence and they lied us into this war. That's it, Jimmy. I mean, that's the absolute bottom line. And so anyway, Carl in Seattle. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Honestly, the more I listen to you guys, the harder it is to keep listening. I'm researching my own exit strategy these days called dual citizenship.
No. Carl, let me recalibrate that for you. What we need to do is we need to get involved and active and take over these political parties. We need to – and not – you know, I'm active in the Democratic Party, but people need to be active in the Green Party. They need to be active in the Libertarian Party. They need to be active in the Republican Party. Whatever, you know, whatever floats your boat – I'm not saying, you know, get out there and jump in all of them, but get active at the grassroots level and support local candidates, because we can take this country back. We have been, it's been worse than this before. It has been worse than this before, Carl. In World War One, you had a Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, pass a modern version of the Alien Sedition Acts and throw people in jail for speaking out. We're arguably almost there, but not quite.
That's what most frightens me is how close we are getting to that, especially when the federal government can turn and go, we don't like the coverage you're giving on the war, stop or we're going to cut you off. Responsible news media would have said, hey, look what they just said.
That's right. The responsible news media would have reported on it at the time rather than 5 years later. Excellent point, Carl. Thank you for making it. And in fact, Chris, if you still have that clip of Katie Couric from yesterday, let's just, lest we forget.
And he says that we didn't do our job and we didn't ask the tough questions and we let the administration get away with what they were trying to do. And I just am curious for your take on this.
Well, we have different points of view, and I'll start by saying I think he's fairly accurate. Matt, I know when we were covering it, and granted, the spirit of 9/11, people were unified and upset and angry and frustrated, but I do think we were remiss in not asking some of the right questions. There was a lot of pressure from the Bush White House. I remember doing an interview, and the press secretary called our executive producer and said, we didn't like the tone of that interview. And we said, well, tough. We had to ask some of these questions. They said, well, if you keep it up, we're going to block access to you during the war.
Now, you got to keep in mind, in the news, in the infotainment business, access means dollars. Because if you don't have access, then not as many people are going to watch your TV station because you don't have the big names on. And if you don't have access, you don't have eyeballs. You don't have eyeballs, you don't make money. And so here the White House is saying to these big corporations that own these networks, we're going to cut your money off if you don't play our game. That's the bottom line. And Katie Couric should have come out about this years ago. I mean, just years ago. Andrew in Long Island, New York. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Real quick, some old business. Last time I called, I guess I made some hard points for you to swallow because after I hung up, you said I got my points from the Republican talking points. I don't appreciate that. I have my own mind. I make up my own opinions, and I don't appreciate you putting words in my mouth like that. I don't think that you should do that.
All right. If I was incorrect in suggesting that whatever you said was being also said by or you, that you got it from the Republicans, I apologize, Andrew.
Okay. What's your point for today? That.
We only have 1 minute, by the way, by the end of,
okay,
for the end
quick,
of this hour.
You know, before when McClellan was the spokesman,
yeah,
everyone said he was a liar, and now all of a sudden he's telling the truth. I mean, which is it? Was he lying before, or is he lying now? I mean,
I think it's pretty clear that he was lying and shading the truth before, and he's now come clean about it.
It's not a matter of his word.
It's his word combined with all the evidence.
It's easy for you to believe it now that he's telling lies. And before, I mean, you got to make a choice.
Because before what he was saying did not.
No,
Andrew.
Wrong now.
Andrew, you asked me a question. Andrew, before what he was saying was not consistent with what we could all see. Uh-huh. Now what he's saying is absolutely consistent with what we can all see.
Worldview is what it was.
No, it's got nothing to do with worldview. It's, you know, look around you. Scooter Libby got convicted for this thing. The judge in the case said what Libby was doing was throwing eyes in the umpire's sand in the umpire's eyes. That he was all about trying to shut the thing down, to stop the investigation. And he did. Why? Well, now we find out that because it would have gone to George Bush. Treason.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program and the third hour of our program. And Jonathan Steele, the senior foreign correspondent and in-house columnist on international affairs for the London Guardian, is with us. His new book, Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. Jonathan Steele, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
You, sir, I believe you made 8 trips to Iraq?
Since the invasion, that's correct.
Since the invasion. And on one of those trips, you yourself were kidnapped, if I understand this correctly.
That's correct, but I wouldn't like to make a big thing of it. It was a very short experience, lasted about 2 or 3 hours. And luckily it was by the Shia group, connected with Muqtada al-Sadr, the Mahdi army. Mm-hmm. I think if you're captured by one of these Sunni extremist groups, your chances of survival are virtually zero. With the Shia, it's usually for some political gain or because they are suspicious of what you're doing, and if they're satisfied that you're genuine, then they'll release you. That's what happened with me. I'd been to a couple of American bases in the city of Najaf, and they thought that I must be some kind of spy, but I managed to convince them fairly easily, in fact, that that was nonsense.
Right, but what it illustrates is that a reporter in Iraq trying to be a reporter is, how do we say it? That normal reporting, that the kind of normal reporting that you would expect to come out of a country is a very difficult thing to accomplish in that country.
Yes, it means you have to sort of live a kind of a double life. You know, on one day you can go and talk to the Shia people, and then if you want to talk to the Americans, you have to do it on a separate occasion so that they don't know what your program is. So you may even have to be embedded with the Americans. The mistake, as it were, quotes unquote, that I made in Najaf, and this was back in 2004, was that I spoke to some of the Muqtada al-Sadr people in the morning, and then having finished my talks with them, my interview with them, went off to see the Americans. So I suppose they thought I was sort of reporting back to the Americans what I'd heard from them, kind of things. And as you rightly say, you can't do that now. You have to sort of live a double life, do one thing one day and something else another, and you know, because of all this suspicion and confusion.
I bring this up because, you know, right now this whole Scott McClellan thing is breaking here in the United States, and Katie Couric, who's the CBS Evening Newscaster, yesterday in an interview just kind of let it slip that she had asked some tough questions of the administration. They called her executive producer and said, "We're going to cut off your access if you keep asking these kind of hard questions." And it's kind of hard to cover the war in this context either. But just this whole issue of how particularly we in the United States, I realize you're British and you know, reporting for The Guardian, one of the whenever I'm over there, I've always found The Guardian to be one of the finest. You know, it's a very progressive paper, but which is one of the finest papers in your country. That reporting in the United States is dying, and it seems to me that first of all, I want to get to the question of, you know, how did America and Britain lose Iraq, the topic of your book and the title of your book, but how also did, in particular, in the United States and to some extent in the UK, how did we lose the how did we get the public all enthusiastic about this, and how has all this reporting gotten so twisted, I guess, is the bottom line.
You mean the pre-war reporting all about the weapons of mass destruction?
Even to this day, you've got reporters who are running around with John McCain going, yeah, everything's great.
Right. Well, I think a lot of it is that people don't talk to Iraqis. They get the British or the American perspective on things, and then they speak to maybe a few of the top politicians, the Iraqi politicians, who are really sort of very close to the American occupation. They don't really get out into the street and talk to ordinary Iraqis and get their impression, and it's become very difficult to do that simply because of this security issue. You can barely go out of Baghdad, and then even in Baghdad you have to make your plans to see somebody and then turn up and not spend more than about a half an hour there just in case word gets around that there's a foreigner who might be a good target for kidnapping for ransom money or for worse. So we're terribly restricted, and I think people don't often give credit for that enough in their reporting. They give the impression to the ordinary reader that they're able to do a proper reporting job, and the results that the reader reads are based on a wide cross-section of opinion, when in fact they're not.
Right. So we think that we're getting the whole story when in fact we're not. And you've actually been out there. You've been, as I said, kidnapped. Your book, Defeat, How America and Britain Lost Iraq. What's the essential?
Well, the essential point is that I'm trying to challenge the conventional wisdom. We all know what that is. It's that the thing was all about blunders made after the Saddam regime was toppled. One blunder is the getting rid of the Iraqi National Army, so there was no security force of any kind, apart from the occupation troops. The second was getting rid of the Ba'ath Party and preventing anybody who'd been a member of the Ba'ath Party continuing in a managerial position, which suddenly meant you decapitated the entire professional class in Iraq, so there was nobody to run the country. But the assumption behind those arguments that it was all about blunders is that there could have been such a thing as a successful occupation if the British and the Americans had been more sensitive and intelligent and run the whole thing more efficiently, there could have been a successful occupation. My point is that this is a complete misreading of the political context and the history of Iraq. And the two countries that have invaded and intervened most consistently in Iraq and in the Middle East in general over the last century, really, are the British and the Americans. So clearly, any Iraqi would be highly suspicious. What is the agenda of these people? They're coming in, they say, to help us, but are we sure that they haven't got their own agenda? And particularly after Saddam was toppled, and when it became apparent there was no weapons of mass destruction, Iraqis were saying to me and other reporters, why are you still here? You know, we hear your president saying mission accomplished, and we agree with that. Saddam's gone, we're glad of that, so why are you still here? And my argument really is that that was a very dominant feeling among Iraqis, and it's never been taken properly on board by the Americans and the British, and they still to this day haven't given a date or a timetable for when they're leaving.
You know, I talk with American Democratic politicians and strongly recommend to them that they should stop using the word war, that we're not fighting a war right now. The war was over. George Bush declared the end of the war on May 1st, 2003. He was right. We had taken down the governments, occupied the country. We'd done all the things that you do when you win a war. Then began the occupation. And they need to take the word war out of their vocabulary and start using the word occupation, because occupations are appropriately ended, and wars can only be won or lost.
Right.
And it completely changes the language of the whole thing. And in fact, in the Philippines, I mean, you know, the United States occupied the Philippines for 40 years in conflict. And,
right.
You know, after the Spanish-American War, before there was any semblance of a semi-autonomous and independent government and stability brought to the Philippines. And there are still insurgents in the Philippines shooting at American and Philippine soldiers.
Right.
You know, have there ever been any successful occupations around the world?
Well, I think there were two, and they were particularly irrelevant to Iraq, and yet they were the ones that Jerry Bremer and other American officials took as their template.
You're talking about Germany and Japan?
The Germany and Japan in 1945, which, of course, were successful. There was no resistance, and things went pretty smoothly. But that was quite different. I mean, Iraq was not flat on its feet after 4 years of war like Japan. It was a very different culture from the ones of the occupiers, whereas Germany, obviously, the German people have very similar values and culture and tradition and background as most Americans, but they just had one terrible period, which was actually an aberration in historical terms of 13 years of Nazi rule. But to come in and help them get on their feet, they were pretty much welcomed. But Iraq is a very different culture from the United States or from Britain, and a very different history and a long record of intervention. And even things like sanctions, you know, for most ordinary Iraqis, they remember sanctions. It's one of the worst 10 years of their lives. But the Americans Bremer would never discuss sanctions. He just airbrushed it out of the picture. He didn't understand. He just thought there'd be a blank check of gratitude for having toppled Saddam, and that this gratitude would last indefinitely.
Yeah, these guys went in with a level of naivete or hubris, I think is probably the more appropriate word. That is absolutely breathtaking, and therefore we're getting our butt handed to us. Jonathan Steele, his new book, Defeat, How Britain and America Lost Iraq, must-reading list. He's the senior foreign correspondent, in-house columnist on international affairs for the London Guardian. And Jonathan, thank you for taking time to share with us today.
Thank you again.
Great speaking with you. Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll tell you, the storm is here. It's that kind of storm you can't talk about on the radio. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Hey, my brother Steve, he sends me a note. He says, yesterday we were talking about original sin. He says, I submit that the story of original sin has been misinterpreted. The original sin was not Eve eating the apple. It was the devil convincing her to eat it through deception. The true original sin is, drum roll, marketing. And Tim in Canton, Georgia, sends me a note apropos of my saying, you know, when Pat Buchanan was like, remember McGovern, you can't, you know, the Democrats can't run as peace candidates. We, you know, subtext in my mind, more war. We need more war. But anyhow, Buchanan saying, yeah, peace candidates never win. And I pointed out that Eisenhower was the peace candidate in 52. And Tim points out to me that in 68, Nixon was the peace candidate. This is from the Nixon Agnew 1968 campaign. Nixon promised peace with honor. He said, new leadership, this is a quote from Richard Nixon, new leadership, that means elect me, new leadership will end the war and win the peace in the Pacific. How quickly we forget. I want to just address this, the larger issue here of what Jonathan Steele was talking about. Jonathan Steele in his book, and a great interview, and what a brave man. A real reporter, as compared to somebody who says, oh, well, the White House doesn't like our questions. I guess we won't ask tough questions anymore. Wouldn't want to lose access, right? Here's a guy who's been over to Iraq 8 times, got kidnapped. But he pointed out, and I've heard this very often, and I didn't want to get into it with him on the air, and I'm guessing he would have agreed with me. There just wasn't time in the interview. But I want to share this with you, because this is such an important point. Whenever anybody talks about the occupation of Germany and Japan being successful, there is an elephant in the room that nobody talks about. And maybe, you know, half the people I know who are very thoughtful and insightful people don't get this. And maybe it's because I wrote a book about the impact of culture on everything else. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is basically a book about how our culture is killing us, not our technology, not our politics, not, you know, and that we have to fix things at the level of our culture. But consider, Adolf Hitler created or bought into or became part of a cult. It was a death cult. The Nazi Party was a cult. It was a religious cult. They were going to bring about 1,000 years of peace. In Wavelsburg, they were building a Vatican, a Nazi Vatican. It had nothing to do with the Catholic Church. I've been there. It was going to be the shape of a spear. It was based on the spear of Longinus, the spear of destiny, the spear that supposedly pierced the side of Jesus, that's in the museum in Austria, in Vienna, the Habsburg Museum, that when Hitler, when he did the Anschluss, the first thing he did when he went into Vienna was he went to that museum and he took that spear, because he believed, as did Napoleon, who lost the spear just before he was defeated, he believed that whoever owned that spear would control all of Europe and ultimately all of the world. He thought it was a talisman. This was a cult. The Nazi Party was a death cult. In Wavelsburg, Scott Berg and I went over there. We were writing a book about the religion of the Nazis, and ultimately we never finished the book, but we did a heck of a lot of research for this thing on the ground, and we talked to a lot of old Nazis, a lot of active Nazis. In Wavelsburg, there's one of the largest SS cemeteries to this day, well, or at least to the date, the time that we were there. Last time I was there was like 6 years ago, or maybe 7 years ago when we were working on this book. All these SS tombstones are polished perfectly. Every day there's fresh flowers on them. We walked in on a black candle ceremony with a whole bunch of guys in their 80s. We passed a house with skulls embedded around the door and runic writing on it. We broke into the castle. You can't get in it. Part of it is a youth hostel, but the keep, this circular 3-4-story keep, it's like that's the word that they use. We broke into it because you're not supposed to be there. I mean, it's and inside was this flame, the eternal flame in the center, and there were 12 positions around where the Nazi leaders were initiated and where their ashes would be buried. Nazism was a cult, a death cult. Similarly, Tojo and Hirohito were running a cult of worship of the emperor, that he was the direct descendant of the god who came from the sun. And therefore, Japanese were willing to fly planes into aircraft carriers, the kamikaze, and everybody loved and respected them because it was a cult. When we defeated Germany and Japan, it was not a military defeat. I mean, it was. But the thing that allowed us to have a successful occupation was that we defeated the cult. In both cases, the people of Germany and the people of Japan, when the people of Japan realized that the emperor was not divine, when he essentially said that, and the people of Germany realized that Hitler was not the Messiah that they literally thought he was, and I'm telling you, I talked to a lot of Nazis, when they realized that he was not the Messiah and he was not going to bring about 1,000 years of peace, which was the slogan of the Third Reich, it was all about peace. When those two cults were shattered, the control, the mind control that those two cult leaders, Tojo Hirohito in Japan and Hitler and his buddies in Germany, had over the people was broken. And when the people woke out of their cult, they were willing to cooperate with us.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
By me. I mean, here, if the reason why the Japanese and the Germans embraced people like my father, who was part of the Japanese occupation. He went over there with the first Japanese occupation forces. He joined the army as the war was ending, not knowing that the war was going to end. I mean, you know, he turned 17 and said, okay, that's it, I'm out of here. And he joined the army to go off and fight the good war. And the war ended, and they sent him to Japan just as the occupation was beginning, and he spent 2 years there. And that was, you know, that was his time in the army, was in Japan with the occupation forces. And nobody ever shot at him. People treated him very nicely. They were very pleased that he was there. Why? And not just him, all the soldiers right across the board. Why? In part because we were helping them rebuild their country. We weren't bringing in Halliburton and Bechtel, and we weren't bringing in foreign labor. We weren't bringing in people from the Philippines or from Thailand or from, you know, other nearby countries who might work cheaper than the Japanese to rebuild Japan. And we weren't seeing it as, and we weren't reinventing it in a neoconservative nightmare fashion. But the bigger thing with both Japan and Germany, the reason why no American soldiers died in the relatively brief occupations of Germany and Japan after World War II, is because in losing those wars, the citizens of those countries awakened from the cult that they had become members of, a death cult that had seized the entire country, the cult of Nazism and the cult of emperor worship in Japan, these toxic death cults. And the people, when they realized the truth literally set them free, and they said, oh, we were wrong. I'm telling you, I have talked with 70, 80, 90-year-old Germans. Now, this is over the last 30 years. It's been since the mid-70s that I've been spending a lot of, and I used to do business in the 1970s in Japan. I've talked with Japanese about this as well. In fact, one of my dear friend of mine, we've stayed at his home, he and his wife and their children, their home in outside of Tokyo. A whole long story. But in any case, I have some very close friends who are Japanese and many good friends who are Germans. And my friend who's Japanese is not old enough. He's my age. So he was born after the war. But I've interviewed people in both countries who were alive during the war and were gung-ho for it. Who, when the war was over and they realized what their side had done, when the Japanese realized about the rape of Nanking, when the Japanese realized what was being done in their name, when the Germans realized what they were doing in Auschwitz and right across the board. I mean, you know, when the horrors of these cults were revealed to them, the Japanese and the Germans said, oh my God. And we said to them, we will help you rebuild your society in a civil and secular fashion, because both of these countries were being run by religious cults. The Nazis were a religion. It was gussied up as Christianity. Bishop Mueller was initiated as the official Reichsbishop of the Church, of the Lutheran Church the official Church of the Reich by Hitler. He had the good graces to commit suicide within a week of the end of the war. But these were religious cults, and the people woke up. And I tell you this, and I share this with you because, the reason why it's so important that we understand this, that we as a people in America, and particularly those of us who are in a position to talk with others about this war, about this occupation of Iraq, about the entire foreign policy, about the entire worldview of the Republican Party and the Bush administration, is that the same thing that happened at the end of World War II in Germany and Japan, where the people realized that they had been defeated, and they realized that their leaders had lied to them, and they realized that their leaders were madmen and cult leaders, that same thing is happening right now in the United States of America and in Great Britain, particularly in the United States of America. Just let that sink in. We're realizing that a cult that has used religion as its front, this cult called the Modern Republican Party, Look at the go to GOP.gov or GOP.org. Go to their website. Look at the stars on the elephant. Just like Hitler inverted the swastika, the Republicans turned the stars on the elephant upside down. It's not the American star. It's not the stars you see on our flag. It's a five-pointed star that's upside down on the Republican elephant. It is the modern Republican Party has become a death cult. It is led by a man, George W. Bush, who believes that the best way to cure anything, any social ill, is by killing people. He was proud of the fact that in Texas he put to death more people than any other governor in the entire 230-plus year history of the United States. He put to death children. He put to death mentally retarded people. He put to death a woman who had repented of her sins and begged for not freedom, just life in prison. Carla Faye Tucker, and then he made fun of her after he killed her, laughing with Tucker Carlson about how, you know, what a hoot it was to put her to death. Tucker Carlson to this day still talks about how George Bush gave him the creeps in that interview, as Bush rubbed his hands together and said, "Please, Governor, don't kill me," making fun of the voice of Carla Faye Tucker. It's a cult. The Republican Party is a cult. It is a cult driven by belief. And now the next guy who wants to lead it, John McCain, tried to bring along the religious guy. He's not so much the religious nut, but he knew that he needed them, because if you're going to have a cult, you got to have religion associated with it if it's really going to grab the minds of the people. But John McCain is every bit as much about the death cult as George W. Bush. John McCain complains that Barack Obama has not served his country in uniform. I submit to you, John McCain has served his country in uniform too much. This is no slam on the military or the people in the military. But our Constitution was put together for a civilian to be in control of our government. The President of the United States is supposed to be a civilian. And while I would suggest to you that Dwight Eisenhower was a great president who served our country, and Grant arguably was a mediocre president who had been a general, maybe even a bad president. It depends on how you want to define his presidency. There's so many different ways to look at it. His memoirs are breathtaking. But that's not how he governed. He had the most corrupt administration of the 19th century. Grant's administration, General Grant's, Ulysses S. Grant's administration, was so corrupt that when he went to the Republic, his own Republican Party, and asked to run for a third term, they told him no. It wasn't until Reagan came along that more corrupt officials had been indicted and prosecuted than since the Grant administration, as I recall. But in any case, what I am suggesting is that McCain, you know, three generations of military, that he has gone beyond the ideals of the military in the United States. It has become, in his mind, a sort of a cult. And there are elements within our military who are trying to convert our military into a cult. They're doing it at the Air Force Academy in Colorado, where they're promoting, you know, Christian gung-ho right-wing evangelical Christianity, which many Christians would say seriously is not a Christianity that Jesus would recognize at all. I remember my mentor, a German, Herr Mueller, who was in Hitler's army. I remember my mentor saying to me, you know, if Jesus came back to earth, what church would he join? And I said, I don't know. And he said, none. There are none of them that he would recognize. But anyhow, so we're having an awakening right now in the United States. This is a turning moment. And it's precisely what Jonathan Steele was talking about. He used that word, that unusable word, defeat, that unspeakable word, defeat. He's saying, we have already been defeated, and it is sinking into Americans. We have lost, if you want to use the language of winning and losing. If we think we have a war, it's an unwinnable war. We have lost. We're And it's time for us to say, okay, you know, we won the war, we're losing the occupation, we're getting out. But it is the awakening. So much blood, so much death, so much loss. The average American family spending a couple of thousand, best guess, $5,000 a year is being added to your tax bill or is being borrowed in your name simply to pay for this war and occupation. This death cult that has been running our government, Americans are waking up from it. And that's why John McCain is not going to be president in 2009. Because Americans have woken up. And he hasn't.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Bust up cult mentality, I'll tell you. We've been talking to Ellen about how the Germans and the Japanese were death cults, and the people woke up from their cult indoctrination at the end of World War II, and that's why our soldiers weren't being shot at and things. And whereas Iraq, you know, wasn't essentially a cult, it was a country, and they resent being occupied, and it's just a world of difference. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Yes, that comparison yesterday was a little iffy, to say the least.
Yeah, yeah. So what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, other than the Scott McClellan hullabaloo, which is huge here, it's like the
it
only
is here
thing
too.
That anybody talks about. And how could a possible person like Scott absolutely go against, you know, the sort of unwritten code of ethics of a White House press secretary? Well, very simple. If they were going to not tell him the truth, and they wanted him to not tell the truth, and they wanted him to shut up, they should have offered him an ambassadorship.
Yeah, well, and also now he may well be looking at the fact that he was involved in high crimes and misdemeanors. He was involved in things that were criminal and that led to the death of a lot of people, and he may be looking at his hands wondering if there's blood on them. And I suspect that this guy had a come to Jesus moment of some sort.
Well,
not
I do too, and I think he had a consciousness. I mean, as I have said to you before, Scott is one of the nicest guys on the planet, and you can't be a nice guy and not be bothered.
Yeah.
Okay, some other things going on. The economy, gross domestic product grew in the first quarter, but it is 0.9%. Now, keep that about Iraq's annual GDP of 7%, and I think it shows you where the American economy is at. Also, the consumers did increase their spending, but a 1% rate, and of course, some of that consumer spending might have been for household items that they desperately needed.
Or it might have been for gasoline or for food or for increased medical expenses. Let's keep in mind that every time somebody's diagnosed with cancer, the GDP goes up by $250,000. GDP is not necessarily a measurement of good economic activity. It's simply economic activity. Every time there's an oil spill, GDP goes up. Every time, you know, if there's a giant forest fire, GDP goes up. Every time, there's some sort of disaster and buildings fall down and need to be rebuilt, GDP goes up. So.
Now, I wrote actually an article for the right-wing blog that I write for, and I talked about the letter that Conyers wrote and then was written back to Conyers from Rove's attorney. And he quotes that Conyers has said before that there was a need to kick somebody's, and I don't think you're allowed to say it on the air, so derriere. And so this was written to Rove's attorney, Luskin. Well, it's interesting. A lot of people are now saying that that is going to get in the way of bringing Roe to the committee and other things. But I think absolutely not. I think actually what's going to happen on the Justice Department situation, you know, with the attorneys, is that they may just, you know, Conyers is not dumb. He may wait until after the presidential election, and then what happens?
Yeah. Yeah, and Barack Obama a few weeks ago was asked, would he consider investigating and prosecuting crimes committed during this administration? Unlike Bill Clinton, who chose not to go after criminals in the Bush and Reagan administrations before him, and he said yes, he would investigate those crimes. So I think that there's a lot of people who are very nervous. In fact, I think frankly that statement of his, which did not get a lot of press play, it sent shockwaves through the Republican Party.
Oh, I think so, too. And I think that we're going to see a very different situation here, hopefully, on January 20th. Also, the Pentagon has asked Congress for reprogramming $9.7 billion from other services to cover the Army war costs. And they say that this is necessary as a preemptive action in case the war supplemental doesn't go through on time. So they're already pouring more money. I mean, that's not even a month's worth, but they're already pouring more money in that.
Would the war supplemental not go through on time because attached to it is the GI Bill of Rights that Bush wants to veto?
Well, I think that among a couple other things that they have on there. But, yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's three separate votes. But, again, in the Senate, it may be a very, very different bill.
Ellen, I've heard reports that Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice, as Christy Harvey calls him.
I love that's a lovely way to put it.
Yeah, it really is. That Henry Waxman has already issued a subpoena or is in the process of, you know, has said he's going to issue a subpoena for Scott McClellan. Do you know if this has happened?
Well, I heard it was Conyers. I also heard it was Wexler. And I think that they will issue a subpoena, and I think that he will definitely go. He's going to do several TV shows in the next couple of days. He's doing Meet the Press on Sunday. And so I think what's going to happen is that he's going to be asked that very directly. Will he testify? And I see no reason why Scott McClellan will not testify under oath. Now, the president could claim executive privilege, but how do you claim executive privilege for somebody who's already written a book?
Right.
And last but not least, let's not forget what the 31st is. That's tomorrow. That's the Rules Committee happening in Washington. Some people are doing all-day coverage. We're certainly going to be there. And Obama has apparently asked
tomorrow
people not to protest, but that's not going to stop them.
Right. That's the day after tomorrow, Saturday.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. Yeah. I've got my weekend confused. It is the 31st, and it is on Saturday.
Yeah, today is Thursday.
I'm going back to New York today, so I think it's the weekend.
I get lost in time all the time, too, when I'm traveling. It can be a real challenge. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, always wonderful to hear your voice. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And by the way, for our listeners in San Francisco, just to let you know, Sofitel, San Francisco Bay Hotel, Redwood City, 7 o'clock tonight, Clinton and Obama, representatives and delegates. We're going to have a conversation, and Angie Coiro and I are going to be hosting this thing. You can get the details at green960.com. And tomorrow, of course, Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, and Anything Goes Friday. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.